I hope you can stay after the reading tonight and have some punch and cookies and tell Richard Ellman how wonderful he is. Our next reading will be 1 week from tonight in this auditorium, visiting poet Bill Knott. Are you having difficulty hearing me? No. We've just put together the third issue of the newsletter, and we keep getting such wonderful news about people's accomplishments that we have to keep stopping and adding things to it. And if you have any more wonderful news, give it to me tomorrow, and I'll put it in the next issue. Richard has written too many books for me to give you the titles of all of them, but I would like to give you the titles of some of the novels. As you know, he writes fiction, poetry, journalism, essays. Some of the novels are The Menu Cipher, The Breadfruit Lotteries, Little Lives, Freddie and Cheryl and the Kids, and Lilo's Diary. One of the books he's very well known for, one of his nonfiction books, is Cocktails at Samosas, a reporter's sketchbook of events in revolutionary Nicaragua. In addition to his writings, he's also well known as a radio personality, having been one of the regulars on NPR's All Things Considered for a long time. His honors include a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, a New York State Creative Artist for Public Service Award, a Penn NEA Short Fiction Prize. He's taught at several universities. He's been a long time teacher at the summer program at Bennington College. He's taught at Sarah Lawrence College, State University of New York. Last year, we were privileged to have him on the faculty here for one term. Those of us who heard him read last year know that you're in for a great treat. It's a pleasure to introduce Richard Ellman.
This is the important ceremony, the pinning of the lavalier.
I think that's going this time. We don't do the kissing with this, do we?
Just the pinning.
Okay, try that.
Okay. Can you hear me? I project a little anyway, so. Well, it's very nice to be here. It was snowing when I woke up this morning in Stony Brook, so I'm glad you all came out on a day like this. I'm going to read a few short things, some very short things, two very short things, and then one thing that's a little longer. They're all, two of them are works of fiction. One's a short, as we used to say. One's a real story. But I'm going to start by reading something I'm working on now. They're all things I've been working on recently. I don't like to read published work. You can go to the library and find that. I've been writing my memoirs. I don't plan to die right away, but I do plan to write my memoirs. I've bumped into all kinds of people in my lifetime, so I thought I'd write a book of memoirs about it. The title of the book is Name Dropping. Why be modest? I'm going to read the prologue, which is very short. And it's called Post Time, as at the I used to play the horses. There are a couple of little epigraphs to the book. I'll read those too, just briefly, to get this thing underway. And I will get you out of here in a reasonable amount of time. The two little epigraphs to this little prologue to this memoir is, one is from a poem that I wrote a long time ago called Curriculum Vitae, which is about people's resumes. And the epigraph is, our list of references usually depicts we were once capable of keeping friends. The other is from a conversation I overheard a few summers back on the beach in Amagansett, which is one of the Hamptons out near where I live. A conversation was it's a piece of a conversation, actually. A woman or a man was saying, I'm not even sure which, quote, it's Phil Lopate, not Phil Roth. He's the other Phil. Or I don't know, maybe it's the other way around. This is called Post Time, and it begins with a little poem. The turf softly raked, and silences are numerous. There's the silence of the clock, of chance incandescent on the tote. Horses calm and separate in their stalls prepare for sound. In the course of the same old race, I find myself writing about some people, how fame seems to set some people apart from us, known and considered otherwise in different ways. I was astonished by Ernest Hemingway's small, weak handshake and by the jolt of force with which Elie Wiesel squeezed my hand once. Of qualities I have known in some, as difficult to assess as women's smiles. How long ago seems knowing too. When I first met Isaac Singer, he asked me, who is this Saul Bellow? Singer's great comic story of faith, Gimple the Fool, has only recently been published from Yiddish to English in a translation by Mr. Saul Bellow. They're both still a long way from Oslo. His features of a medieval saint, even to the faint white-haired tonsure effect about the crown of his skull, were backlit by the glowing monitor from his mischievous incubus. Not who I was, but who I have known. My oldest daughter goes to school for a while in Lake Placid. Another parent with children at the school is J.D. Salinger. Divorce and single part-time fatherhood have made us comrades at a distance. You know, when I first got into this business, I was in graduate school, I was learning how to be a writer. I really expected I'd hear wonderful literary conversations when I met other writers. Mostly it was gossip, backbite, and purchase money mortgages. This is one conversation that isn't about gossip, backbite, and purchase money mortgages. Anyway, once Salinger and I took Thanksgiving together at the same long family table at this boarding school. He was quite a charming, sartorially elegant man in those days, 15 years ago, and he didn't seem to mind looking away from his children a moment to talk about writing. I asked him once as we were driving from our inn to the school in his Jaguar if the world could expect another Salinger book someday. My book? His voice was low, confident, confidential, from the driver's seat where he sat behind the wheel. Richard, he said, it's really nice not to have to publish anything until the work is really completed, and I'm happy with it. The last time I saw Salinger, he was hitting ground strokes on the school courts with his son, who later became a movie actor. Did Salinger Sr. ever seem troubled by his seeming lack of productivity? Not in my company, but maybe for Time magazine. Nowadays, I'm forced to conclude other people's estimations of his well-being were of much less consequence to him than getting proper topspin, showing that to his son at that moment. In long tennis whites, he looked a bit like one of the old champions, or another grayer version, perhaps, of the Central Park camp counselor who appears in his early stories. Who I have sometimes listened to is also important. Hey, kiddo, Henry Miller tells me when we speak about my writing his life story, which I've been contracted to do, don't you think you have a hell of a lot of nerve thinking you could do that? Ralph Ellison tells me once that when he was a young writer, he resented the writings of James A.G. because, he said, A.G. wrote about the poverty of poor whites, and they were the people, I thought, who kept my people down. When Jean-Paul Sartre won the Nobel Prize, Isaac Singer told me, with all the innocence of a centerfold spread in Playboy, this man Sartre, he's not such a good writer, is he? I say I think he probably is, though different, of course, than Singer. When I tell this story a few days later to Elie Wiesel, he says, oh, that is just Isaac's chutzpah. He's too arrogant to read Sartre, and this way he makes his insistence on not knowing seem like a reasonable position. In those days, Wiesel and Singer were both still writing for the Yiddish newspaper, the Jewish Daily Forwards. The collegiality of these two future Nobel laureates was largely a matter of backbite. The poet John Ashbery and I met once in front of his apartment building in Chelsea on a hot summer day. I was just getting off my bike to run an errand. He invited me up to his place for a cool drink. Some weeks later, we exchanged books. I gave him my autobiography, Freddie Shirl and the Kids. He gave me A Nest of Dinnies, which he wrote with the poet James Schuyler. We sit together on couches in his comfortable, though somewhat frumpy, living room, as though divided by opposite sides of a big white picket fence. I tell him I admire his poetry of time as a sort of white noise a lot. He tells me that as an almost unknown in Paris, he also had to do a lot of hack work, crime stories, art crit, some porn, I believe, sometimes under assumed names. Under assumed names, both poets have chosen at times to be fugitives. I learned the limits of literary friendliness one summer at Yaddo, a writer's sanctuary in Saratoga. I was sitting by the pool sunbathing after a morning of writing when the critic Alfred Kazin dropped his big heavy medicine ball right on my stomach. I lost my breath. Surely it was all an accident? To prove it was not, Mr. Kazin took a deep breath, picked up his ball again, tucked in his gut, and then dropped 25 more pounds of leather down on my stomach again. "Look, Alfred," I said. "What's the matter?" he replied. "Can't you take it?" "What's the matter with Elman over there? He's certainly not being very friendly, is he?" I heard Kazin's septum deviating over dinner that night from another table. The poet Jean Garrigue explained to me at dessert that Alfred had always been very shy. Dropping the ball was just his way of making friends. This is a book about some famous and accomplished people I have known over a long time, and some less well, in the course of my career as a working writer. So that's the prologue. The next thing I'm going to read is a short story, very short, what we call a short, I guess.
Short.
This is a story from a collection of stories I've been writing for some time called Disco Frito, which means fried discotheque. It's set in Nicaragua in 1978, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83. I was going there up until about 84. This story is something I witnessed myself, but I've also had any number of Nicaraguans tell me stories like this. And it's because of that that I decided finally to make a little scene, a little short story out of it. It's called Loving Strangers. In the middle of the night, he heard a blabbering loud voice, crying out voice, which tore him from sleep. He went to the window and peered down into the darkened street. Footsteps slapped the pavement, metal jiggled as though someone were getting off, ready to fire off something. He looked directly below just as a dark figure ran across his vision. "Who is it? What are you doing?" Ismelda asked from her slumber next to him. "It must be the police again," Salvador said, "or the militia. They couldn't be so far south." "I don't understand you." She was sitting up in the bed, draped inside the bedclothes. "The insurgents," he pointed out. "I thought it could be one of them." "You mean the enemy?" Her voice carried with it a correction. "The enemy," he repeated her words. "Simeon," she added softly, calling him by a love name, "come back to bed." Gunfire blasted against a wall. "Simeon, back to bed," she said. He turned away from the window in a crouch. "It could be thieves," he shrugged at her softly. "Come back to bed." He ran right in front of our door. "He could be somebody we know." "We don't know anybody anymore," she reminded him. "Come away. Come now." He climbed in beside her and reached for her body. She allowed him to draw her close. "Mano," she said like a friend, "you have to watch yourself close all the time. This isn't your fight." She stroked his hair and then his back with her hands. "People are dying all the time of strokes, too, you know," she laughed at him softly. When he kissed her dark, warm shoulder, she sighed and pulled her gown below his avid mouth. He smelled beef when it's freshly slaughtered. She kissed his face and slid backwards against the pillows. All the time, in the dark streets, a man was flushed from one hiding place to another. There were cries, more shots. When he entered her, she cried out, just as automatic rifle fire exploded two blocks away in the Indian marketplace. The main portion of this reading is this fairly, well, it's not that long. It's a story, new story I've written, which is nothing much I can tell you about it, so I'll just read it. It's called Almonds with the Children of Long Bay. Long Bay is a little town in the Caribbean. The water gleamed like burnt oil, burnt without flames. It gave off its fumes to the still air, almost black, splotched dark blue, banded close to shore with the gray, purple shadows from palm and almond trees, surging gently inland from the surf's mile movements. The beach at Long Bay was like something thrown down suddenly against the water. Behind a narrow violet strip of sand, sparkling here and there, a number of pistachio, lemon, and stark white bungalows blinked among the palms in one direction. A glance down the other end of the cove showed a wreckage of shacks, flotsam of chicken coops, battered old cars, beach dories. Seated in the center of the cove on a piece of beach 5 foot from the water's edge, George Kendrell felt protected. The sky was this perfect, untroubled Caribbean azure, and the lowest inklings of the blue hills, which began at the farthest end of the beach, though lush with cultivations, seemed like stage flats erected, if he ever glanced heavenward, to ensure the privacy of his good moods. Kendrell was dressed solely in white gym shorts. No longer red, he was brownish, orangey, peeling, with bare long legs and big feet that were resting only a little lower than his perfectly wide, moonish grin. He wore no sunglasses. For some minutes, he felt at peace with himself in the world, very calm and very still. But after surveying all the hairy trails and arroyos on his chest, his softly swelling belly, he cricked his face and neck slightly up in a squint of that blinding hot sun to watch the 5 small black children again climbing among the branches of the tallest almond tree in the patio of the nearly abandoned motel where he'd been staying for more than a week. The children were after nuts, just like yesterday. A scattering of shells and half-rotted hulls stained and pocked the flagstones beneath that one great broadleaf tree, which was still quite overladen, ready for harvesting. On the second day of their attack against the almond tree, the children were clearly not playing. They wanted food, they were hungry. They worked over each limb and branch with a desperate joyfulness, one climbing monkey-like along the boughs and shaking, and the 4 others harvesting, and they took turns up high, the others leaving small mounds at the foot of the tree. After a while, more than one child would be up among the branches, raining down nuts at the feet of the others. Kendrell observed they did not often stop to eat any of their precious harvest. As soon as a new rain of nuts fell, they were sorted and swept into those little mounds, or else gathered among the faded upturned skirts of 2 little girls, about 8 and 10, who ran about beneath the tree with their brothers and their friends, their bellies bulging, their bare, scrawny thighs agleam. Very little was said, though there was a lot of laughter, and an occasional command given in Creole from an older sister of the gang, tall, loose, really quite handsome, a grown woman who stood some paces away smoking at a thick hand-rolled cigarette. When she was not supervising the kids in the tree, she would glance shyly up at Kendrell and then look away again, as if not wishing him to know she was interested in him. He thought she was very attractive. The high brow, the long sculptured face, those loose limbs, warm dark skin, her full breasts beneath a thin sketchy black house dress. The thought that she was probably not wearing anything under her dress also excited him. He was more than just curious about her and the children, drawn to her handsome good looks, but unable to engage the young woman in an open flirtation. He turned back toward Janine, his traveling companion. Nice, he sighed and stretched out his legs. Oh, fun and games, she smiled back. She wore a light blue silk bikini. She had boyishly cropped sandy hair, bright blue eyes, pretty bird-like a plum. Seated in a beach chair identical to his own, perhaps 10 paces apart, When she was not trying to attract him to be more than simply his companion, Janine could be quite custodial with Kendrell. Now she asked, "Hungry?" He continued to stare at her, so pretty and clean, without a hair out of place, well-groomed, trim, good bones, slim ankles, fine, well-bred, all-knowing. She obviously enjoyed being pleasant toward him whenever he let her be. As though her question to him now was an irrelevance he could disregard, though not her smiling. "Are you hungry?" she asked again, in the exact same tone of voice, raising a plastic glass of pink rum punch to her face, tilting up her chin, draining it all the way to the bottom, smiling again. He shook his head. "Are you?" He felt he was being appeasing, slightly cowardly. Ever since he'd noticed the black woman 3 days ago, he could barely bring himself to look at Janine openly in daylight, her overseeing presence. He was also ashamed somewhat, aware she knew what was going on and would never say anything to him about it directly. But now she spoke to him with just a little pout of the lips. "Those children aren't just playing, George. They're hungry, real hungry." Was she emphasizing that last phrase with the vernacular to warn him of something, discourage him perhaps? Kendrell didn't like being so closely supervised, but he knew talk would be less threatening to her than more silence at this point. "One would think so," he observed, as if a little too blithely, stuffy from exposure to the sun. "Do you suppose Big Sister said, 'Fetch me some nuts for supper, or there'll be no supper?'" "She might be their mother," Janine advised. "She's old enough." "Oh, do you think so?" He was really angry with her, and hoped she was trying to convince herself as well as him by being so catty. Frowning back at him a little fearfully, Janine said, "I don't need to tell you they get pregnant very young down here." "I know that, but not that young. I mean so many times," he said. "She couldn't be. She's just much too young, too slim and pretty." "There." His attraction was published for both of them to hear and edit. "You do like her, don't you?" Janine said. Kendrell didn't want to feel himself blush. He resisted the feeling without knowing what was happening to his face. "Well, don't defend her," Janine said, turning away annoyed after a while, "because I really wasn't attacking her." She was staring down the beach toward the cabanas, and he found himself counting hairs again on his chest. "Never mind," he said, "just let's forget it. That's fine with me." The surf sashayed. The cries of the children were feverish a moment. A shadow crossed his lap, as if his head had sunken him a bit. The branches of the almond tree shook and swayed once more wildly. Kendrell saw two more of the children ascend the trunk, and then the topmost part of the tree seemed to bend under all their pulling weight, so that their guardian and one little girl left on the ground began to shout at them in Creole some words of caution. He thought it sounded like, "See the wavies." Couldn't make out their exact words, but the woman's voice came very loud and harsh and throaty, without any lilt to it, and that disabused him of some of his fantasy about her for the moment. The climber nearest the ground descended, a few nuts fell too, and he again squinted off toward the ocean. Janine rose from her chair. She tugged at her panties and walked over to the ruffled water's edge, seeming very bird-like and necky when her toes touched the water and she wiggled them. "Lovely," she seemed to make song, bent herself low over the waves and adjusted her straps with the cup of her right hand, splashed at her shoulders, her small round breasts. She splashed herself again and again and cooed and giggled and sighed. She was putting on such a good show. She liked being watched. She was an actress. She wanted George to look at her and never look away. But really, that was not part of the rules they'd made in advance on coming to this island together, and she knew it. And in a little while stopped and held her head up high and was necky and pouted when she saw George gazing off into space again. "Really," he wanted to say, "you're being so childish, being such a little girl." But he followed her movements out of the corners of his eyes and said nothing because he knew the woman and those children were still hanging about and might overhear. Had it not been more or less mutually decided upon with Janine that they would travel together as friends, chums, eat together, of course, sleep together, but just not get too involved? "Let's just try to have some fun together for a while," Kendrell could remember hearing himself more than once. "For a change, I think we can both use that." Of course, some fun. That would be nice. He never agreed to notice her moods. Their sex had been good together, the air of their company bright and easy. She seemed as content as he believed he was. But in the capital, their first night, she almost went off with a handsome black hustler who promised to show her the best reggae and street dancing and some dynamite high green. You know, beauty, real spliffs. George felt tight and abused by the invitation to turn on without him as he watched it transpire, and Janine not resisting. Then he became openly angry and ordered it not to go. "I just don't like feeling left out," he explained later. "Bump on a log." George meant he didn't want their holes to be quite that loose, though he did not have to be possessive, because he had a sort of unwritten title to Janine's attention, squatter's rights, for the duration of their trips. They'd rented a car to drive out to Long Bay, and then the thing between them heated up. Among the coconut groves and sugar fields of Morro Bay, it was hard to resist being with such a pretty, available woman. They made love on beaches, bathed naked near deserted coconut plantations, were with each other and honestly happy for a while, except as soon as they were back on the road, he retreated from her again. His excuse was his fear of getting lost in a strange part of the island. He also wanted to draw back, he thought, with some self-loathing, having once again established his rights to her. Now he blinked at her coldly near the water's edge at Long Bay. "You'll be swimming again, I suppose, if you will." She smiled toward him. Ever since Morro Bay, she'd been guarded with him like that. Her attentions toward him, a weak pulse, were constant, debilitating. Kendrell found her come-ons more disagreeable than enticing. He said, "I'd like to sit here and watch those kids, you know. I may even sketch them after a while." "In that case," she said, as she gave an annoyed peck at all that pure bright air with her pretty head, "I think I'll take myself a little stroll down the beach." She went off through the sand, across the breakwater, toward the inn. "Be sure to be back by 5, he called after her. They were planning to drive to Port Antonio for dinner, though he didn't explain, as if hoping she did not need to be reminded. Janine never turned around, but waved through the air, a slim arm held high, sauntering on, very sidling, provocative, as if cooling herself down in the wind. Watching her diminishing form negotiate the rows of small private bungalows to enter the crowded public beach near the inn, he felt slightly peeved again by what seemed another reproach intended for him. Then the anger died. He was grateful just to be by himself. He could just be good to himself for a while. Gradually, he let his head rise from his shoulders, felt the tension leaving his neck, and then he heard the children rustling in their tree and turned and saw that they and their guardian had also stopped what they were doing to watch Janine's departure. There was a sudden, almost syrupy hot thickness to the air about his face. They were all smiling at George. One of the little girls was bouncing up and down on her bare heels, squealing joyfully. Then the others began to bounce and make happy sounds, teasing sounds. "Nasha," said their guardian, as if she knew she was their target, but the children quieted only for a moment. They all seemed so very pleased for Kendrell and their relative, now that he was alone at last. Slowly, dropping their legs down under them like large spiders, the two oldest children descended from different branches of the tree and fell and rolled about and giggled. There was a little applause and then a lot of panic. The smallest little girl had gotten her skirt snagged on a branch so that she was more or less hanging in peril. Kendrell got up from his chair. He saw the woman gracefully extend her long arms and on tiptoes grab the little girl's bottom and yank her out of the tree. She bent over the child to ask if she'd been hurt. Wildly, the girl shook her head. She whispered, pulled herself away from the woman, who was pointing around a corner of one of the old buildings. The child walked to a place near where the woman pointed, and in full view of Kendrell, lifted her skirts and squatted, a stream of dirty colored water gushing from her bottom. When the child was done, the woman gathered all of her children nearer, and they started to walk toward Kendrell with some of their nuts. "Good day to you, sir. Good day. Lovely, isn't it?" he beamed back at them, though at first he was somewhat frightened by so many bright faces, happy faces. They seemed like a reproach to his customary sense of dread, and they were so easy in their beauty toward him. When they offered some nuts out of their little pink palms for him to share with them, Kendrell worried about taking food from hungry mouths. But the woman, who surely must be their mother, from the broad-nosed family resemblance he now observed up close, gave him such positive encouragement with her nodding, warm smile, he was infatuated with all of them once again. "Take, please take," she was saying. "You'll make the children very happy, and you'll like if you take." Her smile was broad. It broke against her high, dun cheekbones, crinkled her eyes, showed a handsome pink mouth, almost toothless. She saw he was pleased with her, and she was pleased for being handsome to him. "I assure you, sir, you will like." "No, sir," Kendrell said. "George." "All right, sir. My name is Barbara. Take," she insisted. He took a nut, and the children cheered. Patrick, Lally, Sheila, Marcus. This is Mr. George. She had rattled off her children's names with so much familiar insouciance that Kendall could not locate faces as they answered to them. Though each child seemed to be smiling when his or her name was called, he realized they'd all been smiling at him for quite a long while. Kendall heard himself mumbling at a collection of smiling yams. How do you do, George? George Kendall. George. Three cheers for George. We're all just fine, she told him then. But please, you must take more. Take another. We picked for you. Kendall accepted a second nut and crushed the two between his fingers easily, their hard, scaly rinds yielding so readily to the pressure of his thumbs that two shiny white pips about the size of his cuticles almost slipped from his palms before he was able to push them up toward his mouth and chew on them studiously. The fruit was salty and then sweet, a slightly bitter greenish taste. Good, all the children were screaming at him at once. Good? Good as a gannup, he blinked back. They giggled and bounced up and down again, delighted he knew the names of one of their favorite local fruits. Then he heard the woman's voice, and it was rather soft and deep and thrilling to him, but just a little more schooled and English in its accent. Really, Barbara was saying, they are delighted for you. He felt as if she was counting herself out. For what? We all are, she said, that you like. Smiling so warmly toward him again that he felt drawn to touch her. He wanted to reach for her, felt he already knew her in ways he had never known or trusted Jeanine. Well, I certainly must return the favor, Kendall said suddenly. He got up out of his chair so that the soles of his bare feet were burning against the new sand. Come with me, announced, and started up the beach toward the porch of his bungalow. Once, as he led this small procession of children and their handsome guardian, Kendall couldn't resist glancing off to the direction in which Jeanine had gone away. But he did not see her figure among the bathers, nor was she off somewhere beyond the public beach that he could perceive, where the cove bent in upon itself under low hills of banana, papaya, and coconut cultivations. When he reached the wooden porch steps, he turned and said to Barbara and her children, "Make yourself comfortable here. Just wait, and I'll be right back." He went inside to find the big fruit bowl. He had Gros Michel bananas for them and soursops, green and yellow mangoes, star apples, and heavy sprays of the lime green gennep. When he came outside with that big flowered bowl heaped high with fruits, proffered between his outreaching arms, he felt himself also brimming. In the bright glare, the faces of all the children dulled on him, then as though they really did not expect immediate reimbursement for their gift of a few nuts to this nice, friendly person. But he thought he was being generous. They could have all they wanted, and there would surely be plenty left over for Jeanine, with whom he bought the fruits. Take, Kendall echoed their words, do take. Then Barbara said, it's all right to take. All their faces brightened. An octopus reached for his bowl of ripe fruit. Now all of them sat about on the porch, eating the fruits and nuts noisily, wetly, making large sucking noises. Only Kendall lacked much appetite. He worried there wouldn't be enough for everybody. The children and their mother seemed ravenous. They gladly reached for seconds and thirds. The piled up fruit in his bowl dwindled. He believed he was happy in the sun to be giving these people so much enjoyment. When there was only just one mango and a couple of gannips left in the bowl, Barbara noticed a paperback copy of a novel on the porch and picked it up and started riffling through its pages almost blindly with her sticky fingers. Her face was gleaming. You are a professor? Artist, he explained. I sometimes paint. He brushed at the air between them with his right hand, a rather grand flourish of brushes and strokes. Oh, she giggled, showing her bare pink gums to him again as her face broke into another smile. You're famous? Not at all, not really, he blushed. Yes, sir, I believe you are, she insisted and went ooh again before jabbering a few words at the children, which also made them go ooh, as if delighted with him. Kendall, for lack of any more appropriate response, brushed at the air again. Barbara oohed at him a third time, and now she too darkened. He could see the crimson rush against her brown skin stretched tight across those cheekbones, so that it seemed to him momentarily his own feeling for her was being reflected back against his face. His ears burned. Bashful, he cast his glance down at his feet once more. I came here to have a vacation, he declared, and it's been lovely. But someday soon, I may want to draw all of you, because I think you're also very nice and very pretty. Thank you so much, said the littlest of the girls. The others were giggling again. Barbara said, yes, you must come to visit with us. Then you can draw us. Another time, maybe. "Oh, we live very close," she said. "You come with us now. The children will like that, won't you, children?" "Not today." He felt tight all over again. "Oh, yes, you must." "He should, he must," the children said. "But I can't today. I'm waiting for my friend." "You come," Barbara seemed a little gruff. "You'll like it. Come." He glanced across his shoulder down the beach and felt her warm hand grasp his wrist. He shrugged her off. "I'm very sorry." She drew back a hand. There was a sort of hurt in her eyes. Now he knew he'd been drawn to her by something in her, too. An eternity of mutual melancholy he might have ended here at last, if only he had not hurt himself so much now by rejecting her. "My friend, she would notice I'd gone away, wasn't here," Kendrell explained, "and she would miss me." "You mean the lady?" All the children gasped and jawed at him. "Yes, I came with her. She's my friend." "But we were friends," Barbara nodded glumly, and the children all gathered around her. They were all looking very sad. "The man don't wish to come for sure," Barbara shouted crossly down the beach. "Don't you hear the man?" "Some other time," Kendrell was saying. "Perhaps tomorrow, if you tell me where you live, I could come." He knew the effort was futile. They all started to walk away in a single file. "Goodbye, sir. Bye." Waving at him as if he were a moth or a bug, a fly, their heads cast dejectedly against their shoulders. "Goodbye." Kendrell watched their procession along the beach the opposite way Janine had gone. When they disappeared behind the row of shanties near Mama Kelty's store, he felt relieved. He'd no more fruits to offer. He went to the icebox and got himself a bottle of Dragon Stout, cold and very bitter against his teeth. His face felt like a big hot stone. Kendrell stayed alone on his porch all that afternoon, feeling himself as heavy, unalterable and heavy, and leaden, sad. Light glinted dully on the lavender beach. Another and probably bright day was leaving him. The tide came in. He felt abandoned, or that he had missed out on a chance to defy death by becoming involved with such a band of strangers. That his body was not a grievance against his mind. And when the warm winds blew, he felt just bleary misery. Janine reappeared at dusk, a rather thin smudge at first. Her figure enlarged as it alternated with the palms along some nearby, nearly deserted stretches of beach. "Hello there," she said cheerily, at last 3 feet from the lowest porch step. "Been having yourself a party?" Her eyes took in shreds of mango and papaya, pit stems, skins, a bottle around the desolated fruit bowl. Her face seemed very burned and crisp and sere, her nose much too red, and there were reddish smudge marks all along her shoulders and rib cage. She was sweating. "Well," Janine said a moment later, "I'm glad you saved something for me. I guess I'll go and shower. Janine." He was trying to stop her because she was being much too mean. This simply couldn't be another reproach. The woman wiped her hand across her face and left herself with a smile. "I see you didn't get to sketch after all." "Have you been with someone?" Kendrell demanded. She smiled on. "Of course." She started up the porch through the sliding glass doors into their bungalow. He followed her. He watched her undoing herself. He thought he could detect more red marks. He said, "Janine." "Now, George," she spun about so that she seemed scrawny, though resilient, her look determined, her mood bolstered by her afternoon away from him. "Don't you start anything," she warned. "I mean it. I really won't stand for it." The fist of anger in him unclenched. He felt warm again despite himself. He smiled. He felt evil and very sexy and felt quite good and then guilty as hell about all that. "I'm not going to split hairs with you, Janine." His voice was a slur, a leer. "Hurry, because I'm feeling real lonely." Her face was an almost blank. "I'll just pop under the shower, George." Thank you very much. Anybody with questions, or I guess we can talk later.